the training itself is really good because it's the most robust and thorough training that I've ever done. And I often tell people who are interested in furthering their diving in terms of their skills, even if you don't plan to go on with cave diving, doing a basic cave or a cavern course will improve your buoyancy and your trim and your skills and your comfort level so much that it has huge application in the ocean anyway.
It's episode 14 of Dive In the Podcast with special guest Dr. Harry Harris. On this week's special episode, we'll speak to a man that wears so many hats, we'll have to spend a whole episode chatting with him. We'll likely just skim the surface of his fascinating life in technical cave diving, search and recovery work, his book Against All Odds, his podcast Real Risk, his work as an anesthesiologist, and so much more. You may have already guessed who this is, but we'll be speaking with Dr. Harry Harris. I'd list his credentials more completely, but honestly, the podcast is only an hour long, and we got to get into this interview. He became 2019's Joint Australian of the Year, along with dive buddy Craig Challen, for their work in the famous Thai Cave Rescue. We won't chat too much about that rescue on this episode, though. We're going to chat with him about his background, where he's doing now, what he's looking for in the future, and so much more. Hi, everybody. I'm your host, Justin Miller, and with me, as always, Nick Winkler. How are you doing tonight, Nick?
I'm great. Happy to be here once again.
Fantastic. Thank you. And April, how's things going in Ontario?
Things are good. I'm really excited to be here tonight.
Awesome. And Amit, how are you doing tonight?
I am stoked to be here tonight.
So am I, because we've got our special guest of this week's show, Dr. Harry Harris, or Richard Harris. You said only your mom calls you Richard, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right. Everyone calls me Harry. Great to join you guys all the way over there. It's morning here, of course, but I'm fresh and ready to go.
Yeah, I was just explaining to my daughter, my six-year-old, putting her to bed. I was like, yeah, I've got to go downstairs and talk to somebody from Australia. And she was like, Australia? And I was like, it's morning there. She's mourning. Isn't that on the other side of the universe? Yeah. I was like, oh, we need to help you with geography. But yes, other side of everything. Thank you, Harry, for joining us. We look forward to chatting with you. We've got a lot to talk about. Before we get into that, we're going to talk about possibly the worst idea in scuba diving since, I don't know, wireless communications. And that is a team of people are working on a wireless internet connection for scuba divers using a Raspberry Pi controlled laser mounted on the back of a scuba tank. They plan to beam a laser up and back from another object like a boat sitting on the surface, so you can get a raging 2 meg per second connection up to the surface. So I guess you can, I don't know, you won't be able to stream video, but you could post an Instagram after 5 minutes. I don't know. What do you guys think? Sounds like a terrible way to spend your time.
I'm going to go with, just absolutely, I don't see the point. I mean, maybe I'm missing something. There could be actually some good reason behind this, but I really can't figure on the point unless this is an R&D exercise for, you know, later on.
Well, they are university folks, so this could, you know, this is definitely just a bit of fun that they, you know, have for their project that they're working on. But realistically, I think it'd be kind of crazy trying to bounce a laser beam off a receiver on the bottom of a boat from a moving scuba diver.
It's pretty neat technology. I don't know if I want to get Trump's Twitter updates on my Shearwater, though.
If I see somebody taking a selfie from a coral reef, they will be thrown off my boat.
I'd agree with that.
Yeah. Most of our listeners probably don't know that you were in Halifax last year, and Mitt and some of the other divers pulled together a Saguenay dive. So the rumor has it that that was, at least at that point in time, your coldest dive ever and your first Atlantic dive, I guess, assuming outside the Caribbean. Was that the case?
Definitely on both counts, yeah. So 4 degrees, I think, Celsius. You guys are Celsius, I think, aren't you? So
yeah,
4 degrees Celsius, and that was about 2 degrees lower than what I'd previously experienced. So, you know, not a massive shock. At least I'd been in 6 before. But I just want to take a moment to say thank you again to Amit and Jeff Harding and all the guys at Torpedo Rays there who looked after me, especially was it the owner of the shop whose gear I borrowed? He must have been my clone because every part of his equipment just fitted me perfectly. It was extraordinary,
oh,
you know, to
great.
Walk into a shop and get someone's undergarment, dry suit, fins, mask, everything, and just put it on and think, oh, this guy is me. It's perfect. So it was great. And to see, you know, a lobster underwater, something I'd never seen before. I mean, such a small thing that's normal for you guys. It's just a huge buzz when you go somewhere new and you see an iconic life form like the Atlantic lobster. I mean, that was very cool for me. So thank you again, everyone. It was brilliant.
It was certainly a pleasure from our end to have you here. I know it was a huge buzz. And from the very get-go, when me and Jeff started colluding with all of this to see how we could get you in here for a dive, you know, we never thought it was going to happen. I'll be perfectly honest. We were just like, it's a long shot. Let's give it a go. But, you know, we'd be kicking ourselves if we didn't give it a shot. And so anyhow, we really appreciate you coming along and tolerating us diving with you and not laughing too much when we jumped in the water and tried to pretend to dive next to you.
No, you guys were awesome.
So, Harry, your list of credentials and associations is like super impressive and super long for me to summarize. But for our listeners that might say know you from the cave rescue but not know much more about you, how would you describe yourself?
Well, I wonder if I've just been defined by the cave rescue and that's all there is to me now. But no, I'm an anesthesiologist working in Adelaide in South Australia. And I've been diving, which is my number one passion in life, of course, apart from my wife and children, which I have to quickly say. But I've been diving since the age of 15. So that was in 1979. I got my open water ticket. And then when I was at med school a few years later, I started cave diving in the mid-80s. And that was a life-defining moment for me. Cave diving and exploration has been a huge passion for me ever since, closely combined with underwater photography and videography. I'm really passionate about that as well. And in medicine, I've done a few different things. I've worked in diving and hyperbaric medicine for quite a few years. And also done some pre-hospital and aeromedical work, which in real terms means flying around in helicopters and going to road accidents and things like that, which is a pretty cool job. And I've worked in a few different places around the world, like Vanuatu in the South Pacific for a couple of years, which is not a bad place to combine a love of medicine and some scuba diving. I've had a great life. It's been lots of fun.
I was going to ask Harry, like, just on that same kind of note, so what was it that first got you interested in diving, and then that just kind of led you to that path of cave exploration? And, you know, can you tell us a bit about how that worked?
I grew up with a family who had small boats and were into going to the beach, and we had family friends who were also into the same sort of thing. So we used to go on these summer holidays to quite a remote part of South Australia where the beaches were pristine, the fishing was amazing, and the snorkeling, which is what I was doing at that stage, and a bit of spearfishing as a young boy was really exciting. And I remember one of the family friends was a marine biologist. Her name was Pat. And I remember coming back from spearfishing one day and I had an assortment of reef fish which were completely inedible. And I was about 13 years old, and we laid them out on the beach, and Pat, this very sensible woman, rather than sort of scolding me for shooting these poor creatures for no reason, she sort of led me through the species and what they eat and what their habits were, and then very cleverly at the end she said, "Now what are you going to do with them?" And I just suddenly had this light bulb moment of what an idiot I was, and that really opened my eyes to, instead of just wanting to murder these things, to actually start looking at them and being selective, because I still enjoyed the spearfishing for a while, but just shooting what you could eat and just admiring the rest. And before I realized, I was just desperate to get underwater, be with them rather than sort of, you know, floating on the top. And so we had another family friend who ran one of the oldest scuba diving shops in Australia, which happened to be in Adelaide. And this guy had only one leg and he was like a huge pirate. He was a big, bold, loud man. And he ran the dive shop, and I just admired him hugely. So I used to go around to his house, and he had ship's bells and portholes and all that sort of paraphernalia in his house. Mm-hmm. And to me, he was like this pyrotechnical legend, you know. And I just wanted to be like him. So as soon as I could, I went to the dive shop and did my course. And I haven't looked back. I still feel the same excitement and wonder every time I put my head under the waves.
Right. I think we definitely can all feel that.
Isn't just breathing underwater cool?
And you know, so like that's something that still excites me now, like when I teach courses. And I think sometimes the students that that I'm teaching kind of look at me like I've got four heads, because I'll come out of the water the first time that you ask them, like, okay, put your head under the water, now breathe underwater for a second, pop your head back out. And, you know, I'm the first guy out going like, that's got to be amazing. And you have students looking at me kind of haphazardly. So, yeah, it's exciting all the time. They're just kind of, what is wrong with this guy? I didn't think.
Well, you either get it or you don't get it. And if you don't get it, maybe it's not for you.
That's right.
Yeah, I guess I was wondering what shifted your passion from sort of just general scuba diving or like, you know, beginning cave diver to that switch to actually maybe describing yourself more of a cave explorer.
I think I fell in with a bad crowd, Nick. That's what happens. you surround yourself with people whose passion ignites something in you. And that's kind of been the way throughout my life. You know, maybe I'm easily led, but if you meet someone who's passionate about someone and you see their eyes light up while they're talking about it, it's infectious and you want to be part of it. And so in about 2000, the year 2000, I started to hang out with a bunch of guys who were of that ilk, and they were much more advanced than me. They were already long-time experienced cave divers and doing exploration stuff and doing remote trips. And I just caught the bug from them, I think, and they were very generous guys in terms of mentoring me, and I definitely try and do that for younger divers now myself. If someone shows an interest, I'll try and, you know, try and excite them in that same way, because it was a huge gift to me to have the generosity of these guys.
Yeah, it's certainly life-changing.
Before we get too deep into like the cave exploration, so cave diving may be a bit of a foreign concept to some divers, especially for those who don't live near caves. Like, I think we have one flooded salt mine or something up in Cape Breton or Newfoundland. But how does one get involved, and what does an inspiring cave diver aim for?
Well, I mean, there's two parts to that question, obviously. How do you get involved? It's very specific training and requires, you know, going out of your way to get that training. It's not something you should just have a go at yourself by reading the books and trying to follow the basic rules. You definitely need to get appropriately trained. And the reason to do it is it's just a whole new world of beauty that it's incredibly hard to describe. But for me, the thing that drew me in was the crystal clear water and the extraordinary natural light that shines down the entrance of some of these holes. And when you first start cave diving, you're not wriggling through, you know, tight tunnels and taking tanks off in zero visibility water or anything like that. You're diving in these beautiful, big, open, freshwater holes with the sun shining down, hopefully. And the light in those places is it just blows you away. And the clarity of the water, you know, the clearest tropical water that you've ever swum in is filthy in comparison. It's like people use the expression gin clear water. And that's the truth. It's just, you know, your light will go as far as your light will go. There's nothing in its way kind of thing. So once you've seen that, you go, wow, I just want to spend more time here, especially if you've got an interest in imaging and photography. And then, of course, once you become comfortable in that environment, and you actually, the training itself is really good, because it's the most robust and thorough training that I've ever done. And I often tell people who are interested in furthering their diving in terms of their skills, even if you don't plan to go on with cave diving, doing a basic cave or a cavern course will improve your buoyancy and your trim and your skills and your comfort level so much that it has huge application in the ocean anyway. Don't hesitate to do it. And who knows, you might turn out to actually find a whole new branch of diving that you want to throw yourself into.
Definitely. I know that's something that always interests me. I've all the times I've traveled, leading dive trips for different dive shops all over the world. And, I've only so much has gone into some, quote unquote swim throughs through reefs and stuff. And, despite being in Cozumel many times, never made it to the mainland and dove any cenotes in Mexico. So definitely on my list. And I heard your podcast where you were talking about, I think it was on the Speaking Sidemount podcast, where you guys were lamenting spending so many years diving and not cave diving. And that really got me to thinking that I might be wasting my time.
Oh, life is short, mate.
So I just keep trying to convince all these guys to come with me down to Abaco, Harry. Any thoughts on that? Because I think if I recall, your first cave diving experience wasn't the Gin Clare waters, right? Is that correct?
No. Well, Mount Gambier, which is our local site, is in the southeast of South Australia, which at this time of year, which is our winter, you know, it's sort of 12 degrees and horizontal rain. And, you know, back then in 1986, when I did the course, I was a poor medical student. I was in a thin wetsuit and it was thoroughly miserable, to be honest. And you shouldn't expect your training in cave diving. You shouldn't actually expect to see anything because you either have your mask blindfolded or removed forcibly at various times. hence my comment about the training being robust, which is a polite way of saying that they really put you through it. So, you know, I came away from that experience thinking, really, cave diving, this sucks. I mean, it's not great. And unfortunately, a couple of the beautiful sights, which were the kind of treat at the end of the course to make you want to come back, were closed when I did my course. So I never really got to see that. So I didn't get into it for a while. And as I said, it was not until about the year 2000 when I started to regenerate that interest. So I wasted those years. It's great once you get there.
Was there something that clicked for you when you came back to it?
Yeah, well, I happened to get the opportunity just to go for a dive in one of these amazing sinkholes. A place called Kilsby's Sinkhole, which if you Google that, K-I-L-S-B-Y, Kilsby's Sinkhole. If you Google that and find some images, you'll see what I mean about the light in the entrance, and that was enough to get me hooked.
Fair enough. So I wanted to kind of touch base a bit there, so just shifting a little bit, but I know you've got like a huge diversity of experience that kind of directly and indirectly relates to diving. And, you know, I was wondering if you could tell us how that experience and training helped you along your journey to being a cave explorer, and also maybe did being a diver influence your career path as a doctor? Because there's a lot of those things that, you know, when I look at your background and we chatted when you were here, like the hyperbaric medicine piece, you were a diver before that, like the emergency medical piece, but then you teach cave diving. You know, did those things sort of have a play back and forth for them where one was influencing the other, or how did that work for you?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, my career has often wandered around thinking, how can I go diving with this part of medicine kind of thing? So I should say I'm not a cave diving instructor. I was an open water instructor while I was at university. We had a really vibrant dive club at the university with a couple of hundred members and three boats and things. It was really, really cool. So, but I quickly realized I'm too selfish to be an instructor. I just want to go diving for myself and I'm happy to take people with me, but I mean, being an anaesthetist, it's all about gases, obviously, and and diving in hyperbaric medicine was an obvious place for me to go. It tends to be staffed by anaesthetists in Australia, or emergency physicians, or occupational physicians, and obviously there's a military element to that as well, to that specialty. So that was a natural progression for me to get involved in that discipline, and I really enjoyed it. Unfortunately, in South Australia, there weren't quite enough divers getting bent for my interest, which did a lot of wound healing treatments and things like that, which wasn't the real focus of my interest. The diving medicine was my focus. But the 2 years that I spent in Vanuatu, I also ran the chamber there, and the President Coolidge, which is a fabulous shipwreck there, which is a shore dive, actually starts at 20 meters at the bow and 70 meters at the stern. That provides plenty of cases, so that kept my interest going there, so that was good, all with good outcomes, fortunately. So, yeah, no, I've enjoyed mixing my medicine with the diving.
I was really curious about that when I was thinking about how to, you know, what kind of things would we talk about here. And, you know, that translated really well, because when you were here last time, we had the opportunity to stop by the RCMP, the underwater recovery team. We'd visited Mark Bishop, a friend of mine and now yours. And so you'd mentioned at that time that you'd done a lot of work with the Cave Search and Rescue, Cave Divers Association of Australia, Australian Cave Rescue Commission. I mean, the list goes on, International Underwater Cave Rescue. You work with the police department, Australia's police department for water operations. So, how, you know, the thing that's always shocking to me is you've you're doing the cave exploration. You're an anesthetist. You've got a full-time job. How do you end up doing this sort of thing off the side of your desk? Because that's not a short task list, right? And I've only probably mentioned half of the things that you were doing in relation to this.
Well, you know the saying: if you want something done, ask a busy man. I find that if my desk is clear for a minute, then I quickly look for another project to ruin my life again. I don't like sitting around with nothing much to do. I like to be overcommitted. So, you know, just when I had a small lull in my life a couple of months ago, I thought, well, let's start a podcast like you guys are doing, and that will ruin my life again. And sure enough, it has. I can
feel that.
I hadn't realized how much work it was going to be, Justin. I'm glad you sympathize. But, yeah. You know, all these adventures, all these projects bring rewards and benefits. You know, I've been talking to the most amazing people through the podcast, as you guys have been doing, and it's all worthwhile. You don't want to die wondering, you know, I should have relaxed a bit more. No way. What was the question?
I think that was basically it. It was, you know, like how does a person like you do this stuff off the side of your desk? And it sounds like it's really just a passion for living life to the fullest is what I'm hearing, and, you know, not want to leave any stone unturned when you're sitting there wondering what's underneath it. And, you know, I feel like that's a fantastic philosophy, something that if more of us did, we'd probably be happier people overall. So, I think you pretty well nailed it.
And I think the stuff about the rescue work, which is all voluntary, I'd like to say it's a community service, but it's also a great adventure, you know, going and training for cave rescue, whether it's dry caves or through sumps, you know, the underwater sections of a cave. I get a lot of enjoyment out of doing that, and a lot of it was selfish as well. You know, the idea came to me in 2008. We were out on a very remote part of Western Australia, the Nullarbor Plain, which is very famous for its amazing cave diving. And my mate Craig Challen, who was involved in the cave rescue, and I were out in a very remote dry chamber about 4.5 kilometres underground through sumps that we had to dive to get there, and carrying our equipment over this mountain, underground mountain basically, back to the third sump, the next lot of water we wanted to dive. And we're sort of hopping from boulder to boulder, carrying scuba tanks and things. And I suddenly thought to myself, if I fall over and break my leg here, who on earth is going to come and rescue me? And I realized there was no one, and there was no thought or capability had been, you know, put in place. So I came away from that trip thinking I should try and run a little bit of scenario-based training just for a group of experienced cave divers, just to talk about what we would do, how would we approach that. And it kind of grew from there. We got the police divers, the search and rescue people, and others to come along and be part of that initial think tank and training program. And we did it over a few days down in Mount Gambier, culminating in a live exercise, which we learnt heaps from. And subsequently, I've run that course every year since, pretty much. And that was what really put us in good stead for Thailand, because we'd actually run through some of these scenarios, you know, the sort of desktop planning, pre-planning that a lot of emergency services use to prepare for something that might never happen. And along the way, we had a lot of fun and did some cool diving and met lots of fun people. So, and working with the police has been really satisfying to get that mutual respect going between some volunteer civilians like us and professional divers and rescuers like the water police, like your mate Mark, who, by the way, was incredibly generous with his time showing me around the operation there. So it's been good. And sadly, we've been utilised by the police a couple of times to do body recoveries subsequently. And this is a kind of a very common theme in the USA, where the sheriff's department will use a group of known and trusted cave divers to do the body recoveries for them. And so this was a new phenomenon for Australia. So there was a big leap of faith by the police to allow us to help them on, you know, in their jurisdiction, obviously. And that relationship's built stronger and stronger from that point on. So I think it's a useful service to be able to offer.
Now that sounds incredible. And so, you know, not to kind of linger too long on that point, but because it's of interest to me, but Did you find at all that the, you know, the reception was constantly good? Because we don't do that as very much here in Nova Scotia. I mean, potentially the largest reason being because we don't necessarily have the expertise of folks doing higher level diving. You know, we have a few technical divers that are around, but was there any resistance at all from the police, or was that more or less a welcome, you know, kind of a relationship?
There was grave reservations, as you would expect, because, you know, the police are wholly responsible for the outcomes. And if a civilian dives in a high-risk operation, you can imagine the questions that have to be answered. And so the first time that this happened, we, you know, that it went all the way up to the police commissioner and to the Minister for Emergency Services to get the authority for us to be utilised in this way. So, yeah, and I completely respect them for having to go through that process. And, you know, at the end of the day, it was a personal trust, you know, relationship issue. You know, they had a group of us who I'd like to think that they had some faith and trust in to do the right thing and to be sensible. And that paid dividends in the end. And it all came back to that, maybe that first training session where we involved them so they could get to know us and vice versa.
Just listening to some of the podcasts you've done and just starting off in your book here, you've mentioned a passion for photography and cave diving. And I was just curious, as a photographer myself, what draws you to it? And specifically, like when it comes to caves, what's the draw there?
Well, I will quickly add, Nick, that I'm not in your class when it comes to the photography. I'm very much a passionate enthusiast, and you know, good results are few and far between for me. But it started as soon as I got that dive ticket when I was 15. A friend and I went halves in a Nikonos 2, and I remember we paid $150 for it, so $75 each. And I probably took advantage of my friend a little bit because I knew I was going to pretty much use the camera and he might, you know, occasionally, you know, come for a dive. But and we used black and white film, which I developed in my father's cellar, which I converted into a darkroom until I was about 21 when I suddenly realized that wine was actually more important than photography again. And then and I had no strobes, no lights of any kind. So the photos were just natural light silhouettes of reef fish and things. And so you can imagine how appalling they were. But I've still got a couple of the 8x10s that I printed out. And I look on them very, very fondly. And then when I got my first job as an intern, as a doctor, and got a paycheck, I raced out and bought myself a secondhand Nikonos 5 and one strobe. And you know, started to actually get some photographs that were exposed and you could see the colors of the fish and this sort of thing. And then when I started taking the camera underwater and it was still film, when I started taking the camera underwater into caves and it was still film, I quickly took a huge step backwards and would print out 36 black photos with no light, no nothing in them. And I was very disheartened. And it wasn't until digital photography became a thing, and my first decent camera was a Nikon D100. And I started, you know, within one dive of looking at the image on the back of the camera, adjusting the exposure and retaking the photo, I learned more about how to expose a photo properly than I had in the last, you know, 10 years or whatever. And so my and everyone else's photography just took off, I think, at that point. And I really started to re-engage with underwater imaging. And the motivation for me was perhaps to show people, particularly in caves, something that they couldn't see for themselves. I wanted to bring back these images and say, this is what we see. This is why it's so cool, especially those natural light photos of the entrances. I mean, it's just so beautiful. Yeah, and I'm still trying to get the hang of it.
Yeah, I can't imagine doing film photography on the water. That just thinking about that blows my mind.
Macro photography was the great savior because you could actually get some nice shots and expose properly and things. But as soon as you put the wide angle lens on, then, you know, trying to get that balance of foreground and natural light background meant that you had to really understand what you were doing. And I didn't. So it was bad.
I believe that.
So you mentioned doing a little diving in the Castlegard cave system in Canada. A lot of people don't know much about cave diving in Canada. I mean, we have some truly famous cave divers like Jill Henrith, and I'm sure there's a long list that I don't know. But tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Well, I was very lucky to get to know a guy called Tom Crisp, who is actually a British New Zealander who spent a couple of years living in Alberta. And he is a very keen diver and cave diver, a fantastic young explorer, actually. And he fell in with the Alberta Speleological Society, the ASS, which I'll leave to your imagination. and there's some amazing cavers in that group. People like Katie Graham, who are on the world stage of cave exploration. She's just a living legend. She's as good as any caver around the world and totally driven and physically, you know, out caves all the guys on the trip. She's just she's a force to be reckoned with. Anyway, so Tom and Katie, Craig and myself went and explored a couple of caves in Canada that Tom had his eye on, and the cave diving was spectacular. It was bloody amazing. And Tom said the whole place is like this. There's caves everywhere and there's not many cave divers. The caving community had been quite busy and there's some very impressive and challenging vertical caves, but a lot of the cave diving hadn't really been touched, so he was very fired up about it. And we were staying in Canmore at a guy's place, one of the cavers, a lovely guy called Jason Levine, and he brought out the book about Castlegard Cave, which is really world famous. It's, you know, over 20 kilometres of horizontal tunnels, a little bit of vertical stuff, but at the off one of the side branches is a sump which had been explored to its terminus. It's nearly a kilometre long, 20 metres deep at the start and slowly comes up to where it comes into the dry chamber. And the guy who explored it, a Welsh guy, had got to the end of it, but he was by himself. His rebreather was malfunctioning slightly and he was rightly too nervous to get out of the water and start exploring the dry cave beyond. So with a little bit of maple rye whiskey on board, we made this plan to come back and do the sump in Castlegard Cave. And had I known what that involved, I might not have been so quick to agree to it. But anyway, whiskey makes man brave. So I, myself and Craig and Tom, supported by all these fabulous cavers from Alberta Speleo, did this expedition in March this year. And you have to ski basically up the Saskatchewan Glacier. It's about a 21-kilometer ski to get to the cave. And then you camp in the entrance to the cave. Now, I'd sort of forgotten about the part where it was going to be minus 25 and you're sleeping on ice on the floor of the cave. And then you have to drag all your dive gear for about, I think it's nearly a kilometer into the area where the sump is, and the caving is just cruel. You can basically only lie on your belly or just kneel down and roll your packs in front of you and drag them through this cave. It takes about 2 to 3 hours to get through there. I went through three sets of knee pads and it just completely destroyed me. You know, I couldn't sleep because I was so cold. I could barely eat because I was so cold, and then I was completely shattered by the caving. And actually, when it came time to do the dive, Tom, Craig and myself were going to be the divers, and one of the rebreathers was busted on the trip in. And so I actually very gladly said, you know what, I'm knackered. I don't think I can dive. So so Tom and Craig did the dive, and they successfully explored some of the cave beyond. But so I was slightly ashamed of my performance in there, I have to admit, but it was my first experience of that kind of cold, and it really unsettled me, and I found that I was somewhat lacking. So I need a little more training might need to go down and live in Antarctica in an igloo for a couple of months or something before the next attempt. But boy, it made me very, very impressed with the Canadian caving community. You're a very hardy bunch.
What's the temperature like in the water in the caves?
That was about 4 to 5, so okay. Similar to you guys showed me.
No good lobsters, old Nova Scotia though. To prepare you.
Yeah.
No lobsters.
Yeah, we definitely do some dives that are, you know, minus 23 with wind chill and water's minus 2 during the winter in February, March. So, yeah, we feel you there. It gets pretty brutal.
It was the living in those conditions for 12 or 13 days that really wore me down. I just couldn't get warm at any time for 12 days. And I thought, I'm going back to the tropics.
So one question I have, Harry, I've been a little bit quiet. I've just been...
You've been very really quiet, April.
I've been enjoying hearing what you have to say. I feel a little starstruck right now. But
I thought you might just be saving up a really evil question for me.
Maybe that too. One thing our listeners know, and a lot of people in Nova Scotia, is I'm really passionate about the female dive community. So I have my own club in Halifax, and it's called the Sea Foxes, and it's an all-women's dive club. And we really try to promote women in diving and encourage more women to get out, because we see lots of women getting certified, but not many continue on diving. So I'm curious what the how many female cave divers there are and what that kind of presence is like.
It's pretty significant, actually. There are less than men. There's no question about that. But I know in Australia, the local cave diving is very well represented by females. I would say about, I'm completely guessing, but maybe 20 to 30% of the divers are women. And I certainly see no difference in terms of their skills and their keenness to explore and their ability to, you know, shuffle heavier gear around. I mean, they're a tough group, I have to admit. The women, female cave divers and cavers that I know are often better and tougher than the blokes. And right. Maybe you need to be pretty driven and pretty strong as a woman to, you know, just because it's an arduous sport. There's one woman that we dive with and cave with a lot called Sandy Varen, who's part of our little eclectic group called the Wet Mules, which is a very informal association of a bunch of like-minded idiots. And Sandy is tougher than most of us. She reminds me a lot of Katie Graham, actually, just very driven, very strong, and extremely competent. So, yeah, no, plenty of ladies in the sport. And, that's, you know, amazing. People like Jill Heineth, who you mentioned, inspirational. There are quite a few women in diving who really inspire me. Jill's definitely one of them. Christina Zanato in the Bahamas is fabulous. Becky Kagan Schott, incredible diver and underwater cinematographer. No, the list goes on.
I'm really happy to hear that. And your daughter is a diver, am I correct?
Yeah, she's just turned 20 and she had asthma for a long time, and she was the only one of my three kids who showed a real interest in diving, but I was kind of keeping her at arm's length until the asthma sorted itself out. And she kept pestering and pestering. So it was about a year ago or 18 months ago that I said, look, go and see another doctor. I'm not going to certify you. Go and get a proper assessment by a friend of mine who's another diving physician. And he put her through the ringer, did all the spirometry and a thing called a mannitol challenge test, which provokes asthma in anyone who has that tendency. And she passed with flying colors, completely non-asthmatic anymore. So I said, right, let's go. So she did her course with – actually, it was funny. The guy who signed her off, whose name is John Bent, which the irony of that won't escape you, he was my instructor, my open water instructor I was 15 years old, and he's about 70 years old now. And whilst he didn't actually do the hands-on teaching with her, I got her to sign her certification card. So that's a very cool cycle of life, I think.
That's incredible. Really cool. That's amazing. Well, if your daughter's ever in Nova Scotia, I hope she comes diving with the Sea Foxes. We'll make her an honorary member.
Oh, that'd be great. She'd love it. She is so desperate to travel, and she's so cross about the coronavirus at the moment. So,
no.
I won't mention that invitation to her quite yet.
Yeah. Not yet. Soon. I think that's awesome. It's really it's special. Like, I know I go diving with my dad all the time, and my dad taught me how to dive, and I guess it's a similar situation. I have two siblings, and I was the only one who really followed in his footsteps of loving diving. So it is, it's a really special bond, father-daughter bond.
Yeah, it is really nice to do something special with each of your kids, and for Millie and myself, the diving's the thing. And so I took her out on a local wreck about 4 or 5 weeks ago, and the water was still not too bad. It was about 16 degrees, but she froze. We did three dives in one day, and she got so cold. She's not as fat as her dad, so she needs to put on a bit of weight. And Yeah, so she hasn't tried a dry suit or anything. She's only done about 6 or 8 dives since her course, so she's very much at the beginning stage, but she loves it, yeah.
That's awesome.
Well, that's really definitely great to hear. We're going to take a quick break, Harry. We'll be back in just a moment, everyone, after we hear a word from our sponsors. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to take a second to thank our sponsor, Torpedo Rays Scuba. Torpedo Rays is a local dive shop in Nova Scotia. If you're not in Nova Scotia, that's okay. They've got a wonderful website, torpedorays.com, TORPEDORAYS.com. All of the scuba gear you could ever need is there. If you can't find it, give Jason a call, 902-481-0444, and he'll be happy to help you out. In these challenging times, it's always great to shop local. Don't go to a huge, big box. Help support your local dive shop. Buy something you've had your eye on. Excellent time to make a good deal. Buy a gift certificate to use later. Whatever the case may be, Torpedo Rays and torpedorays.com will be there for you. Once again, their number is 902-481-0444 or torpedorays.com.
Yeah, so Harry, I do a Thing Blue segment here on our usual podcast episodes, and ocean conservation is something that's a close thing to my heart. And I was curious about cave systems because they're unique, and in many cases, you know, like you mentioned, humans are the first, you know, cave divers might be the first humans to visit them in a long time, and some of them are fragile. Is there a particular concern for cave conservation in the world of cave diving?
It's a massive concern, Nick. Yeah. We have a code of conduct for cave conservation, and also for during rescues as well, a specific code of how to conserve the cave during a rescue, because that's something that often gets forgotten, of course, when someone's at the back of the cave injured or worse. And, you know, you feel terribly conflicted every time you swim into a new tunnel that no one's ever visited, because you know that tunnel will be irreversibly altered for the rest of time. You know, there's never been air bubbles in there. Just that simple fact that air has now been introduced into that micro ecosystem might somehow upset the balance of the bacteria that live on and eat the rocks, for example. So there's no such thing as exploration without damaging the cave. It's impossible. So we are very conscious and feel very conflicted by the mere act of exploring. But, you know, and when you see a cave that has been discovered for the first time, and then you go back a year later, if it's in an area that a lot of cave divers can access, and you see the total and utter destruction, essentially, of, you know, the floor, the ceiling, the walls, you know, that feels terrible. So that's a really hard thing to balance. And personally, I still feel very uneasy about the whole process. And there's so much interesting and fragile stuff in there, whether it's just the geology or the biology, the hydrology, you know, all these things are affected by our presence. So I don't know what the answer is, Nick.
Oh, no, I was just curious because it's just another system that people move into, and I imagine there might be some parallels to, you know, reefs and things like that. So it's interesting to hear that perspective.
Yeah, and it's much more immediate and much more obvious than in the ocean, because it's a smaller area and you can't – it's very hard to move through some caves without at least touching something, you know.
Yeah, I have never cave dived. That wouldn't have crossed my mind. But thanks for that perspective.
So, Harry, I'm going to kind of follow that one up with you know, the Pierce resurgence. I mean, this has been sort of that long time obsession of yours and I guess Craig's as well. And I think recently you guys decided to do a quick dip down to 245 meters, or about 804 feet for the people that are calculating in feet. But if any of our listeners wanted to have a look at that, by the way, Harry's got a wicked video, Vimeo channel, and he's thrown up a video on that. So I encourage you to go have a look at it. It's fantastic. Sorry to plug that in there, but I sat there and probably watched it 4 times. So can you tell us what that's like? Because you just mentioned, like, you know, these ideas of you're moving into caves, you're in areas where it's sensitive, and, you know, you're moving through that for the very first time. What's that like? And I guess there's a 2-part section in this. The other part is of particular interest in that video. You and Craig get separated at about 200 meters, I'm sitting here thinking I get worried if I'm separated at 100 feet, much less 200 meters. How do you deal with that? Like, you know, I mean, you guys were just so calm about how you dealt with it. So are you able to kind of give us some insight into the Pierce and how that works?
Well, the first thing to know is that Craig appears to be completely indestructible, so you don't need to worry about him. So that's you can tick that one off. It's every man for himself at that point. No, the Pierce has been our signature project since I started going there in 2007. There was a guy called Dave Appley, who's an amazing Australian caver and deep diver, shipwrecks and caves, who took me on a trip there, and that was it for me. I was totally hooked on the site. And the object of diving this cave, which is in the South Island of New Zealand, it's a Vaucluseian spring, which means it's just crystal clear water that comes up from the bottom of the earth, it seems. And the water is as pure and clear as any water in the world, basically. And the idea for us is to try and find the source of the flow. And we've done dye tracing from a cave about a kilometre away. But at the moment, the underground passage, the underwater passage, is heading in exactly the opposite direction and getting deeper and deeper and deeper. So there's this sort of hydrological mystery, which has become quite an addictive problem, probably dangerously addictive, I would say, to try and solve. And I really just want to get to the point where it turns around and heads back. So I know it's, you know, we've got to that point. For me, I think that'll be enough. Mm. But it remains very elusive after 13 odd years of going back there trying to find this source. We have had another team, including Sandy, the girl I mentioned before, diving from the cave itself to try and come back the other way. And that's very different type of diving. It's sump diving, a lot of dry caving, a lot of vertical stuff, very, very arduous conditions to drag dive gear through and trying to connect the dots, if you like. So, you know, we've gradually been working our way deeper and deeper over all these years. It's been a very gradual and careful process. The water is only 6 degrees, and as the dive times have extended from, you know, 5 to 8 to 12 to now 16 hours, we've obviously had to develop strategies to protect ourselves from the cold is the number one priority. And to that end, we've adopted this habitat technology that a lot of deep explorers around the world are using. And actually it was Dave Appley who put the first one in at just 7 meters in depth so that we could get ourselves partly out of the water to do the final hour or two of decompression. And we now have 4 habitats in the cave, one at 7, one at 16, one at 28, and one at 40 meters. And so we spend time in each of those on the way up, which means we've had to develop, you know, breathing systems for each habitat, communication systems, 12-volt surface-supplied heating cables, all sorts of stuff that has made it increasingly complex, but to maintain the level of safety and risk which is acceptable to us. You know, it takes about a week just to set the cave up in terms of putting all the habitats and all the cables and wires. It looks like complete chaos down there once you know, the man-made hazards are much worse than the cave for the first 40 meters because there's so much crap in the cave. But then once you get past that, you're into the tunnels. And the first tunnel is basically a vertical shaft that drops down to 115 meters, and then it turns into a 45-degree tunnel that essentially goes all the way to where we're up to with a few zigzags and big rooms and things along the way. And one thing, you know, getting back to the issue of cave conservation, fortunately, this particular cave is essentially indestructible. It's made of marble, which is, you know, compressed metamorphosed limestone. So it's totally unscratchable and undamageable. And there's essentially no silt, so it's almost impossible to silt the cave out. So cave conservation is much less of an issue in a robust site like that. And, yeah, so on the last dive, we got down to 245 metres. There's another hole dropping off to the left of where we tied off the line, heading down deeper again. Looks like quite a bit of flow comes up out of it, so that's the way forwards. It took us 38 minutes, I think, to get down to the bottom and then 15 and a half hours to get back to the surface with all the decompression that was required. So it's a bit of a thing.
Wow.
That is a fascinating video to watch.
Yeah, the logistics and the technology have become as interesting to me as, you know, the actual exploration, how to do what is a deep dive and do it safely to make sure the risks are manageable. because there's no question that getting down to the 250-meter mark, you're starting to get to that edge of the envelope where physiology and equipment are becoming as much of an issue as the you know any of the other hazards in the cave. You know, from an equipment point of view, finding lights that will survive the depth is pretty much every dive we have something implode. So we have multiple backups. And I have to tell you, when one of your lights or a little buoyancy tube or something implodes, it sounds like a shotgun going off in your ear. It's quite unsettling at 240 meters. So it's funny how we've almost got used to that and expected it. But every time it happens, your heart just misses a couple of beats and you sort of feel yourself, was that my head or, you know, Am I still intact? Is the rebreather still working?
You've had a scooter implode, if I'm not mistaken, as well, right, at depth?
That was in a cave in Thailand, actually. Before the cave rescue, I was over there exploring a cave which turned out to be just under 200 meters deep, and one of the scooters imploded just at about 130 meters, actually. And it was an old, plastic, one of those types of plastics, an old Halcyon scooter that really wasn't rated for that sort of depth. And boy, did that make a noise.
Well, we'll talk about that. You can let me know which one I shouldn't buy after the show.
Yeah, but slowly we've worked out what equipment is working for us. And there's certainly some brands which I completely trust now after many years of trial and error.
So I'm going to move on a little bit there because – so there's a couple of things in there that I think we've talked about, like your medical history, the work that you've done towards rescue work and organizing with different groups, and sort of your career path altogether, kind of culminating with Craig and the time that you guys spent on the Thai rescue. I will circle back to about 2019 and roughly this time, and you and Craig get chosen to be Australian of the Year. And, you know, I think if somebody hadn't spoken to you before, they might think, oh, wow, well, you know, Harry and Craig went over and they rescued these kids, and therefore that means that they're Australian of the Year. When in fact, when I did a bit of research on that, there was significantly more that weighed into it. So how did that come about that you guys ended up there? And can you tell us about what that meant to you, how it impacted your life, and now, so how have you settled back into being Harry now that there's a 2020 Australian of the Year to take up that mantle?
Yeah, it's a strange thing, the Australian of the Year. It's a local phenomenon, obviously, that I don't think really is replicated in any other country in the world. And I think the idea behind it is it's supposed to be a little bit of a morale boost for the country to nominate four people in four different categories who are examples of what Australians should be like. And it's designed to G up the country every, you know, once a year and to say, come on, we can all do better. Mm-hmm. And the people who have received the top award, the Australian of the Year, over the past have been extraordinary people by and large. I mean, national heroes. And when I look back through the alumnus of people, it really does make you feel very undeserving of an award like that. You feel like you do not belong in that company. So the response from Craig and I was acute embarrassment, I think, initially. We felt that it was completely undeserved. And, you know, basically we felt like a couple of ordinary blokes who were really one-trick ponies. We felt like we'd been involved in this thing in Thailand that we willingly attended. You know, it was at the outset an amazing adventure, something to be part of, and we wouldn't have missed it for all the tea in China. But of course, once we got there and we realized that there was a bit more at stake than perhaps what we anticipated, and the thought that actually these kids are all going to die and we're not going to be able to get them out alive, then the gravitas of the situation became clearer. But, you know, we just did what we were trained to do. We'd trained ourselves in this type of rescue, and, our backgrounds as experienced cave divers and both being medical people, Craig's a vet by trade, so, he had great experience with using the drug ketamine. And it didn't really feel like something extraordinary, if that makes sense. It just felt like, well, we're here with this amazing bunch of cave divers from Britain and Europe, and everyone's there just sharing this common goal to do their best for these kids. And so when we came back to all these accolades, it really felt awkward, I have to say. And I really wish that it would just all go away, to be honest. And it didn't kind of sit that comfortably with me until in my role as the joint Australian of the Year with Craig, I decided that I was going to get around the country and speak to as many young people in particular as possible and try and motivate them to have a life outside their, you know, their virtual lives on their screens and try and ignite a bit of passion for adventure and exploration and taking some risks. You know, sensible risk-taking, I think, is so important to make people grow and become resilient and a bit tougher. So I was talking to a group of kids early in the year, and this real tough-looking kid in the front row at the end of my talk, he looked thoroughly unimpressed by what I'd said. And he put his hand up slowly and he said, "Dr. Harris, do you really think you deserve that Australian of the Year award?" And I went, I thought, you know what? I said to him, you know what? I don't feel like I deserved it. But I just had this light bulb moment in that time. And I said to him, but what I'm going to do is make sure by the end of this year that everyone else feels like I was the right guy for this award. And so that really, that kid actually helped me get over myself and move on and try and, you know, do something worthwhile with an award that wasn't really about us. It was about the country and, you know, what it represents. Mm-hmm. So that boy saved me, really.
I really have to appreciate that, because, I mean, I've spent probably 10 years working with at-risk youth. And so for you to take that initiative and actually move the way that you have with it, I think really does make a difference. So I just want to say thanks for that.
Yeah, it's been hugely satisfying. And working with a couple of different charities for disadvantaged kids and kids at risk, taking them bushwalking with a charity called Operation Flinders and things like that have been really worthwhile. And actually, I feel like this whole thing's done me a big favor, because I was just living my own bubble, going about my life and not really thinking about other people until then.
Kind of tying into that, I heard you talk about interest in producing some TV shows of cave exploration and such. Have you thought about tying that into to the youth and putting it in front of their eyes and like getting a Instagram presence going, and, you know, maybe some YouTube stuff and connecting to them that way, if that's still an interest in what you're doing?
Hey, do you want to be my marketing manager, Justin? That sounds like a brilliant idea.
No, Justin's really good.
I haven't specifically thought of that angle, but that is an excellent idea. But along the lines of the documentary filmmaking, you know, that's been a long time sort of thing that's been simmering away inside me. And about 10 years ago, I started to pitch some ideas to people, and they all went, "Oh, it's a really good idea, Harris, but, you know, what's the hook line? Where's the real angle?" And I couldn't really get it to catch. But with this newfound fame, I guess, it has opened a few doors, and people are at least giving me the time to listen to the ideas. And I'm now working with two different production companies, one in Sydney and one in Singapore, to develop a pitch, which was actually about to go to market when Corona hit. And so it's just been put back on ice again. But we think we've come up with a really good concept for a documentary series, which is based around exploration. And I'm hoping that it will see light of day again next year.
Yeah, I'd hope to. I hope so too. I imagine Netflix is just throwing money out everywhere right now, looking for more content. So maybe that'll play into your favor.
Yeah, well, I thought they might, because everyone's sitting at home watching streaming TV. So I thought it might actually make it easier. But the professional producers and production companies I'm working with feel like we need to just bide our time a little bit, because no field production can really go ahead at the moment. Mm-hmm.
That's true. Yeah. We do a lot of film production here in Nova Scotia, and it is all quiet right now, unfortunately.
Yeah.
So now that you're kind of talking about these production pieces, you're running a podcast now, Real Risk. And all of us have had the opportunity. I've been listening sort of from the beginning, and all the guys on the show here have been listening as well. I guess you talk about the impact that high risk activities can have on your family. And I think that was really probably one of the angles that I hadn't even considered when I first started listening, and one that I was pretty interested in as you got going there. And so are you able to tell us a bit about how you manage that impact with your family? And has that ever led to you making a decision to maybe call an expedition because of the, you know, because of the risks associated?
Well, I think the older and more sensible you get, the more conscious you are of good risk management. And there's two sides to this. The first side of it is just the time away from home on expeditions. And that's probably been the biggest bone of contention in my marriage, to be honest, between Fiona, my beautiful wife, and myself. And, you know, it's highly selfish and self-indulgent to go away for, you know, a month and just go cave exploring in a part of the world that where you might actually be completely out of touch. I mean, in New Zealand, for example, we're essentially out of contact with our loved ones at home for the time that we're in at the cave. The valley is such a steep-sided valley. There's no way a satellite phone even will work in there. We do have communications with the local rescue authorities through an HF mountain radio system, but that's it. And so, you know, she does sit at home worrying, particularly with the deep dive day approaching, which she knows roughly what part of the week that will end up being. You know, she sits mm-hmm. at home worrying quite a lot about me. So I feel really bad about that. But I guess obviously not bad enough to not go. So, you know, that's a difficult, that's a moral dilemma. And I like to joke with her and say, well, what if Mrs. Hillary had told Edmund not to go to, you know, Mount Everest? And she just gives me that look of many years of, you know, tolerance. And so yeah, that is a problem. Yeah, well, the second part of the question I think I was going to talk about was your own maturity in managing risk. And I reflect back on that recent expedition to Canada where I decided not to dive because I just didn't feel good about it. I didn't feel like I was physically and mentally in the right place because the difficulties I was having managing just the environmental conditions with the cold and the lack of sleep and so forth. And I'm sure that 10 or 20 years ago I would have just done the dive and, you know, told myself to harden up. But these days I recognize it's not worth it. It's not worth the risk if you're not feeling right.
So, Harry, every week I do a safety tip on the podcast. So this week I thought it would be interesting to ask you, what is a safety tip you would give divers, especially now that we're talking about risk? I feel like it fits in here pretty well. So what's a safety tip you have for our listeners this week?
Well, the facetious side of me would quote you the three first rules of the Wet Mules Diving Club. And the first rule is have fun. The second rule is don't die. And the third rule is safety third.
Oh. I love it.
But I don't think that's the right message to send out to the diving community. So I'll immediately retract that. And in all seriousness, say, listen to yourself. You know, there are days when you don't quite feel right. You don't, you know, sometimes it's a sort of a sixth sense that you can't quite put your finger on it, but for whatever reason it is, you just don't feel like today's the day you want to go and dive in that cave or whatever. And absolutely should listen to that and surround yourself with people who respect that decision. If you say, you know what, boys, I'm just not feeling up to it today, I'm going to have a coffee and you boys enjoy your dive. And if you have people around you who say, come on, mate, you'll be right, you know, jump in, you'll feel better when you're in the water, then you should distance yourself from those people. It's incredibly important that self-protective mechanism. And, you know, a lot of risk-taking athletes, including the ones I'm talking to on Real Risk, I think especially of Sean Tumor, the base jumper I talked to, he's done more base jumps than any other living person on the planet, over 6,700. And I said to him, the obvious question is, why are you still alive when so many people you know are not? And he said, it's because I can walk away. I've got good judgment. And I think that's the key.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, I think that's that comes through that sort of that level of like self-confidence and your ability to just make people feel at ease when you're diving. And, you know, like I've been lucky enough to dive with you here, albeit not in a cave. I'm going to qualify that with a yet because I'm hoping that I can scratch that one off of my list at some point. But one of the things that struck me most about you in the experience that I had diving you was sort of that level of humility that you're talking about, which is to recognize some of these things. And as a diver, your interest is is also in connecting with folks, encouraging people to just get out and do it, but you do it in a way that that kind of moderates their risk for them while still being very encouraging. So you're possibly one of the people who didn't laugh at me, I think, when I mentioned an interest in cave training and encouraged me along that path, which I'm still trying to, you know, pursue. But I found that really refreshing as a novice diver, because all too often, I think you bump into people who make goals seem unattainable, or they're really only for the most elite of folks. And so, you know, have you always, Harry, had that approach to diving, that sort of level of humility and that approach to diving? You kind of touched a bit earlier on a bit about that, but is that a trait that you developed along the way, or was it influenced by other people? And, you know, how's that been an experience overall for you?
Oh, I don't know, Emmett. I don't know if I've ever had that level of self-analysis to answer that question. It's probably easier for someone who's looking at me rather than to look at something like that from within to answer that question. But I do want to say that I've actually reassessed my thoughts on you and your diving, Emmett, and I've completely changed my mind. I think you're the worst diver I've ever seen, and I retract any encouraging statements that I might have made to you. I think you should hang up your fins immediately.
You just crushed a myth world.
All right, I'm selling my X-Deep gear now. So you're like, I just posted it on Kijiji. It's being sold. I'm putting an end to this dream as we speak.
Very wise. No, you got to get down to the Bahamas and do that course, mate. It'll change you forever.
Yeah, you know, I was hoping to be there this year, and this COVID thing is not playing along well. So I think, like your daughter, I'm sitting here very disgruntled. And probably Justin, Nick, and April have to listen to a lot of my griping about not doing that, not even mentioning my wife, who probably has had enough of me by now. Without question, I hope to be able to kind of pursue that at some point here.
Yeah, good.
To jump back in, talking about your podcast, and then, of course, if anybody's not subscribed to Harry's podcast, Real Risk, I definitely recommend jumping on and doing that now. And there will be a link for that in our show notes absolutely sure. But yeah, it surprised me listening, as I think you said several times, you're surprised that all these guys don't tend to be the Red Bull, you know, crazy type. Or maybe you knew that a little bit going in, or were feeling that. But have you found any, you got anybody coming up, you found any like oddballs, or is there anybody out there that you think it's all very calculated risk takers?
Well, I had this suspicion going into the podcast, and that was kind of a theory that I wanted to prove to myself, that people were going to be like me, that they actually don't consider what they do to be very dangerous, because how could mm-hmm. you get out of bed in the morning thinking there's like a 50-50 chance you might die today? Because no one could do that, surely. Mm. And the base jumpers for me were the one that I was really curious about, and because that just seems so dangerous to me, as I think right. cave diving seemed to the guy I spoke to, Sean.
Right. Yeah.
Although he must be slightly crazy, because he said, oh, actually, maybe cave diving would be fun. And I've never heard anyone say that before who had no knowledge of the sport. So maybe there is something wrong with him. But he was such a nice guy, such a laid back, very zen, mm-hmm. very thoughtful about what he does every day. And it completely shattered. That was the final one for me, to shatter this illusion that these guys are all adrenaline junkies who screech and holler before they hurl themselves off a cliff. They are nothing like that, and neither are cave divers, neither are any of the risk-taking people that I've spoken to so far. But look, I'll find one day who's completely mad.
Oh, yeah, okay. So that's the goal, to find the crazy one. That,
yeah, give them the,
that
give them the award.
50-50
give them,
every
give
day.
Give them the Darwin Award.
Excellent. Boy, we have gone much longer than we planned here, Harry, and I don't know if we have if anybody has any last questions for you here in a second, but I just wanted to give you a chance to plug your book and your podcast and anything else you have going on that you'd like people to know about.
Oh, well, that's very kind. So, the podcast is a really exciting project for me. So, I'd love people to give some feedback on it. I'm very open to, telling me how it could be better. So, it's called Real Risk, and you can find it on all the usual podcasting platforms. And I've got some really cool guests coming up, including a couple of quite famous ones. And I don't want to jinx the chance of having them on the podcast by naming them yet, but there's one absolute superstar who the whole planet knows who has agreed to be on it, but you know, you've got to have them at the microphone before you can right. say you've got them. And yeah, the book about the Thai cave rescue against all odds, which is a bit hard to find outside of the Southern Hemisphere, apparently. But you can find it on Book Depository or Amazon, hopefully.
And we'll keep our eyes open for all of that, and then your amazing documentaries to come in.
Fingers crossed.
Six to ten weeks or something.
And just to give you guys a pat on the back as well, I've listened to most of your episodes, and I'm actually really enjoying them. It's good to just hear a bit of banter about recreational diving and conservation and photography. It's all really good stuff. So keep up the good work.
Oh, thank you.
Definitely appreciate that. Appreciate the feedback as well. You know, it's always hard to find honest feedback, and I know this is not probably the situation where you get honest feedback, but I'm just going to accept it as such.
Well, you heard me give Amit some honest feedback, so don't worry.
Career is over. So,
hey Justin, before we go,
yes, ma'am.
You know what?
Oh yeah.
What, April?
You're gonna need to get another frog now for Harry.
Oh, you need a Harry frog.
What's a frog? I heard her talk about a frog, but I can't remember what it was about.
Around the same time we started this podcast, I started a aquarium because it was we were on lockdown here, and my kids love the fish, as you might imagine. And so we started a freshwater aquarium, and we got some of these little African dwarf frogs, and then promptly named them for everybody on the podcast.
Oh, that's
nice. April likes to check in on them every week and see how they're doing, of course.
Well, how much would a new frog cost?
Oh, I mean, you know, they're in the fives of dollars. So
Well, if you get a frog called Harry, I'll give you $5 next time I'm over.
Oh, there you go. Justin, you've got to now.
Well, I guess this is some sort of verbal contract. So
I think so.
Or you can just buy me a cup of Tim Hortons coffee.
And then I wouldn't give that to my worst enemy. That crap. That's the worst coffee in the world. I have one complaint, and one complaint only, about everywhere north of Mexico is that the coffee is undrinkable.
Atrocious.
I'm sorry. You guys have got to sort that out.
We're going to work on it for the next time.
We'll try.
Need more Italians.
We'll put together a task force of some sort.
Fly someone in from Rome.
Yeah, we'll get that sorted out for you before you come up here again, for sure.
That'd be great.
No problem. I think that does it for today's episode. I'd like to thank my co-host, Amit. Thank you very much for being here this evening.
Incredibly happy to be here and to have this opportunity to chat with Harry again. Couldn't say enough, but thank you very, very much, Harry.
You're welcome.
And April, thanks for being here tonight.
Yeah, this was amazing, and it was an honor to chat with you tonight, Harry. Thank you so, so much for coming on the show.
Thanks, April. Good to meet you.
Yeah, it was awesome.
And Nick Winkler, again, thanks as always.
Great to be here. Thanks, Harry, for the pleasure to meet you and to chat with you. Thank you very much.
I love your photos, mate. Keep up the good work.
Thank you.
And I'll take my fourth chance here to say thanks again, Harry. It was an excellent episode, and man, so informative. And we hope we can get you back again sometime in the future and maybe talk about, you know, I don't know. There's just so much of your stuff you've got going on, so I can't wait to see what happens next.
That'd be great.
Awesome. You can follow the show on Instagram and Facebook with @diveinthepodcast. You can email us at diveinthepodcast@gmail.com. Or you can send us a voicemail on our website, www.diveinthepodcast.com. If you send us a voicemail, we'll do our best to play it back on an upcoming episode. You can find me at iDiveOK. April is at April Weichert. Nick is at Nicholas Winkler Photography. You can find links for everything we mentioned on today's episode in the show notes on our website, diveinthepodcast.com. We'll see you on Monday when we speak with Alana Valencott. She's a coral farmer, a conservationist, and a member of Diving with a Purpose. This episode of Dive in the Podcast was brought to you by our sponsor, Torpedo Ray Scuba. Head over to your favorite podcast app to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. It's very much appreciated. Thanks for listening.